The ability to explain things is a peculiar kind of skill, and it has never been really given a name, as far as I know, and has never been quantified. If you want to see a doctor, you know what their skills are, but if you want to find a good explainer, how you can do that, I don't know. My father, although an engineer, also wrote books and was a good explainer.
Welcome to MakeCast, I'm Dale Doherty. Back in 2009, Charles Platt saw that the existing books on electronics were not hands-on, and they were rather dull. He saw a big opportunity to do things differently, and he created Make Electronics, which is now the best-selling book on electronics. He has now revised the book for a third edition. In this conversation with Charles, I learned more about his background and his goals in writing a book to explain the fundamentals of electronics in a practical, hands-on way. How much involvement did you have in the early computing industry?
I was a science fiction writer, and then I worked for Wired magazine, and that's how I made my first visits to Silicon Valley. And as soon as enjoyed the environment there, I realized that was something I wish I had been there for in the 1970s, 1980s. But I was pretty much a latecomer and got in through the back door, really.
You're born in England?
Yes.
What was formative in your background to either get you interested in technology or science fiction even?
My father was an automotive engineer, and I acquired that attitude towards the world where you're sensitive to the things in it which make everything function, and you want everything to function efficiently and smoothly. And I was interested in mechanical engineering, but electricity seemed a lot more interesting to me because you could do it on such a small scale. I didn't really want to go crawling under cars. I liked the idea of sitting and playing with components. And that's really how things started. And I was fortunate to go to a British school where we had a lot of nerdy people. The word nerd did not actually yet exist, but that's who we were. And there was a competitive spirit. People built their own audio amplifiers, for instance, using vacuum tubes, of course, in those days. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. Where did you develop your understanding of electronics and electricity, as you say?
Partly from my friends. My best friend's father was in the Air Force, and he specialized in electronics. Some of it trickled through. It was very difficult to find information generally. There was no introductory book on electronics that I could find. And a lot of it, as I say, came through my friends and through Electronics World magazine, which had projects in it, rather like Nuts and Volts magazine now.
One of the reasons we're talking today is you've just completed a third edition of your Make Electronics book, which for those of you that may not know, but it has been an amazing bestseller of a book. Tell us what you were trying to accomplish in electronics book that you thought needed to happen based on your experience growing up and what the people needed.
I wanted to write the kind of book I wish I had been able to read when I was a teenager. When Make approached me and asked me if I would be interested in this, yes, of course. So my first step as a conscientious writer was to read all the other books and see how they did it. And I was surprised to see that nothing much had changed in many decades, that the books were still approaching the subject in the same way. And I saw a real opportunity here to do it a bit differently with a total hands-on approach so that you learn by making things yourself, which sounds obvious enough and yet wasn't really being done. And this in turn opened up this approach, which I call learning by discovery, where the book doesn't actually tell you what Ohm's law is or something of that sort. you put the components together and see what happens, and then you can figure it out for yourself pretty much, with, of course, some guidance along the way. So it's a matter of try it, see what happens, make some deductions. Mm-hmm. And that's how science, in experimental science, is done in the real world. It's much more interesting than being told, here's a theory, and now maybe we might have a little opportunity to prove it before we go on to the next theory.
The conventional way, in a sense, was to put theory ahead of practice. And I always thought the making way was to put practice first, and the theories emerge. You begin to ask why. You begin to wonder what happens if. And that helps you get into that theoretical understanding. But until you've actually had some of those experiences, the theory, it's incomprehensible in a way.
Yes, it's out there as a theoretical construct, which is hard to relate to anything in front of you. The interesting thing is that writing a book like this goes against one's intuitive habits as a writer, because education is a process of explaining or passing along to people what you know. And you really have to, or I really have to, exert some self-discipline not to tell the whole story right away. So, no, you try it first, and then let's talk about it. Mm. So it requires restraint on the part of the writer.
Yeah, it's actually sort of a good thought for teachers out there. It's actually one of the things I've always seen around engineers when they get involved in mentoring, is they often think their job is to share everything they know rather than look at it from, say, a student's point of view and figure out how they get to the answer themselves and right. how they begin to ask the right questions. Basically, they really won't walk away with what you know, even though you've told them that. So basically, your book, it is really stuff you have to do. One of the interesting things I thought about your book, for some folks in this audience that might just be using Arduinos and things like that, you're working at a much lower level than just plugging a few wires into a microcontroller. You're trying to really get the basic fundamental science that you use here.
That's true. But microcontrollers are wonderful. And I learned computer programming before I got serious about hardware. So I enjoy programming a microcontroller, but it still has to interface with the outside world. And what are you going to use to interface? A relay, a transistor, an LED, a sensor? These are all low-level components. And if you don't understand really what they're doing, if you don't understand the beta value of a transistor, its ability to amplify, you're not really going to be able to do things for yourself, which is the objective I think I'm always working towards. It's not enough for me just to say, oh yeah, put a transistor here and don't ask how it works, it just does. So low-level components are not going away. You're still going to need them. And I think that's why the book continues to sell year after year so far, because people can see that the fundamentals of electronics haven't changed.
15 years old, 16 years old as a book now. In a third edition, you've made some changes to the book to reflect changes in the world. But as you say, the fundamental learning in the book isn't different.
It's basically the same menu, but the dishes on the menu have been changed a little. I revised some of the circuits completely to make them more elegant, simpler. The component list has been reduced somewhat in collaboration with a company that makes kits. It's just a friendly collaboration. I don't have any special personal interest in the kits.
To be clear, the kits is just a convenient way to get lot of the components you need to do the experiments in the book.
That's true. And in fact, I know people who've read the book who have done none of the experiments at all, but they still enjoyed it because they imagined doing all the experiments.
Right, right.
And I think they got quite a lot out of it on that basis. So yeah, you really should be putting a transistor on a circuit board and applying some voltage, but you can imagine it. That's another alternative.
Before we got on here, you held up a jacket from Fairchild Semiconductor, and really that's why I asked you the question about Silicon Valley, is this whole age that we've been, you know, living in, the information age, whatever you want to call it, is really a product of these transistors. And they're not necessarily recent discovery, but they really go back to some of the fundamental companies in Silicon Valley and some of the research that was in the post-war era.
Shockley, who was one third of the team which discovered the transistor, moved to Silicon Valley before it had that name. And then, of course, he had his splinter group of people who decided they were going to go off on their own direction. I think the early days of Silicon Valley are really fascinating because there was a sense of, we don't know where this is going, but it's very exciting. And everyone could be very innovative and in a very loose, informal group. And yeah, I sure wish I'd been there for that.
And it's interesting when you see the history in some ways of technology, which I think follows this pattern a lot of times, is they don't always know what this new thing is for or how it will be used. They're looking at the properties of it and making it smaller or cheaper or whatever it is. But they're also waiting on others to figure out what kind of things you can do with it.
Right.
And I always thought that was the maker's place in the world sometimes, is to, there are new components, but actually combining them in new ways to solve problems is still much needed, like in an application level.
And that goes back a very long way. The 555 timer, which is probably the most successful integrated circuit chip in history, in that it was in production for 50 years. At one point, they were making 1 billion a year worldwide, and it's still in production from several manufacturers. I was very fortunate to speak to Hans Kamenzin, the guy who developed it single-handedly. You can't do that anymore. And he said he was astounded by the things that people had ended up using it for. And that's the hallmark of a really good design, when people can see things to do with it and take it off in these strange directions, which I think is also what happened with the Arduino. I don't think they imagined some of the applications that it was assigned to. No,
certainly not. And one of the things I find interesting about that is it's the convergence on something like Arduino for solving problems, that since what you had before then was sort of custom boards or other things that were hard to design for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But when the Arduino became, or just 555 timer, became a standard component for solving certain kinds of problems. And you could benefit from working with a standard component because other people had knowledge of it. And if you learned it for one thing, you could apply it to another thing as well. I think that's one of the areas that you've covered a little bit more in this new edition is the integration of microcontrollers, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a section in the second edition on Arduino specifically. And I can't know everything about everything. Mm-hmm. And microcontrollers are part of my repertoire, but not the center of my repertoire. So I had to do my own digging around to find out what had been happening in the last few years. And I contacted people who have Arduino at the center of their lives. And I was fascinated to find that it's becoming like the old 7400 integrated circuit chips. It's becoming just a standard in itself. And I didn't expect it to still be so central in the microcontroller field, but it is.
As you said earlier, I don't think they expected it to be. Its original position was you would use the Arduino in a prototype and then discard it with a much more sophisticated or custom board once you figured out the application. But people, right, in a sense, went from prototype to product with it and used the same code and used the same board. And
so now we have vastly more powerful. We got single board computers. We also have a new microcontroller, which is the heart of the Raspberry Pi Pico, came out earlier this year. Yeah, it's much more powerful. It has hugely more memory. But you can still program it in a version of C. You don't have to use any other language. So some things change and some things don't. And the things that don't change become extremely useful because everyone knows about them. You don't have to explain it over and over again. and it becomes part of common knowledge. Yeah. But you still need a book, and I think books are the most convenient way to learn. That's my particular bias, that will guide you into it. And another interesting thing I discovered is that in some areas of microcontrollers, there's a shortage of an all-purpose introductory guide, because it's all open source and each person maybe writes their own little guide to it if they do something new. And it's not like there's one go-to source. So I was thinking about that while I was writing this book, trying to bring everything together.
I don't know if you see yourself as an expert. I'm coming at it a little bit because you say you're a writer. And I think one of the jobs of writers is to understand what experts understand, but also understand that you didn't know that and try to explain it to other people, which is, I always found, particularly in dealing with engineers and other things, they often have digested lots of information, and what they know, they're often not able to express. And the sequence of learning is lost on them because it happened a long time ago. Whereas someone that comes at this fresh and says, I'm trying to figure this out and this doesn't make sense to me, is in a non-expert mode about this subject.
Very definitely. The problem with being an expert is you forget what it was like before you were an expert. And there are so many things which are so obvious to the expert, he or she may forget to explain them because they're too obvious. And I run into this again and again when I'm reading a book myself, because I mainly learn by reading books myself. I'm not so big on formal education. Again and again, I see someone who has failed to mention something really obvious because it was too obvious to mention. So as a writer, I constantly have to imagine myself back in a naive state and write from that point of view.
In some ways, though, that gets you in that questioning mode as a learner. Why? And do I understand this? And not just accepting, like, here's the phrase that they use to explain this, and whether you understand it or not, you just use that phrase again. So that inquiry into what is going on is original rather than just secondhand.
The ability to explain things is a peculiar kind of skill, and it has never been really given a name as far as I know, and has never been quantified. If you want to see a doctor, you know what their skills are, but if you want to find a good explainer, how are you going to do that? I don't know. My father, although an engineer, also wrote books and was a good explainer, so I think that's where I picked it up from. And of course, I taught a lot of computer classes when I used to live in New York City, and was constantly studying myself while other people were learning from me. I was trying to learn from them the best way in which to explain things. And I also used to teach literature courses, which was very frustrating because you could never tell at the end of the course if anyone had really learned much. But when I was teaching computer programming, either they could do it or they couldn't. So I knew immediately whether I had succeeded or not.
I know. I was an English major and then learned programming after school. And I always thought, boy, this is wonderful. The logic is it's right or it's wrong.
That's right.
And very if clear. It's wrong, you go about fixing it. And that's a very satisfying process.
Very satisfying. And another thing I learned when I was teaching was that some people don't really need classes. They're there because their employer told them to go there or whatever, because I used to do adult education. But others can only learn easily when they hear it, which to me is very strange because I don't like learning that way. So naturally, when I'm writing a book, I am not appealing to the people who need to hear it. But there, fortunately for me, there's a number of other people who can learn very easily by reading if they are undisturbed and left alone and no one messes with their concentration. They learn very well by reading, and I get emails from them telling me how much they've learned.
Tell me about that. You must have heard from a lot of people over the years about your book and the impact it's had on them.
Well, I was slightly radical by insisting on including a special email address, but I included it in every edition of every book that I've done for Make. And people said, oh, you'll be overwhelmed with time wasters. Maybe once a month I get someone who may seem just a little bit annoying, rather persistent and refusing to believe what I write back. But generally speaking, it's a wonderful resource to hear directly from readers. And one thing that it taught me is that although I had imagined the book for the teenager I used to be, I was getting a lot of retirees who would say, I finally have time in my life to learn about electronics and I love your book and da, da, da. So I guess I've received over the years about 4,000, 5,000 emails, something like that. And in many cases, the feedback's valuable. People find occasional errors, even though we think we've found every conceivable error, there's always one more tiny little thing. And so we get to correct them. And people ask me really interesting questions. And some people are extremely knowledgeable in other fields. Like I had a video game designer who knew much more about choosing random numbers than I did, because that's part of video games, action video games. But he didn't know about the stuff that I knew. So we got into this great correspondence, in which he ended up by creating this hardware random number generator, which was like huge and ambitious and perfect. And I love that kind of stuff.
It's very satisfying to know that your book is being used and people benefit from it in a variety of ways. Like the maker world has lots of people, lots of areas or fields in it. And I always thought you might be really strong in one area, but the other area you're a novice in. It is a matter of getting time, like you're retired, to say, I'm going to go over to this adjacent area and really try to understand it really well. I'm glad to hear that we have those people out there that are doing it. And another aspect of your book that I think is wonderful is that you produced this book. You didn't just write it. You have a background in graphic design, a degree or something.
When I was dropping out of Cambridge University, where I was supposed to be studying economics, no one ever told me what this was for, but I figured they must be right that I should learn something somewhere. My mother said, if you're going to drop out of Cambridge, you have to learn a trade so you won't be a burden on the family. So why don't you go to the London College of Printing and Graphic Arts since you're interested in being a writer? It was total non sequitur, but yeah, whatever. And yeah, I have a higher diploma in printing management. And the classes at the college which interested me the most were all about typography and color theory, which turned out to be extremely useful now that I'm designing my own books, which is a rare and special privilege for a writer. Yeah. And it also gets me into dealing with the design department at Make, where there's a very wonderful woman who fills in the gaps in my knowledge. And you know, there's an initial process where I have to prove I'm not totally ignorant, you know. And I do understand leading and all, you know, kerning and all the rest of it. Yeah, I know far more than I need to know, but that's just the function of age.
Yeah. One of the things that I find so fascinating about computing and technology is how much there is to learn and how much you benefit from it. There's another face that technology puts on for us, is it how easy it is or how simple it is. But the complexity is worth really embracing and understanding. And I think, just as in your book, really getting to understand electronics. It's not necessary. You don't have to understand this, but it is like opening up a new world that you get to know and understand how to use it effectively.
It's possible to pick things up. And I know someone, actually my local postmaster, believe it or not, has bought his own, he bought the BeagleBone, he bought a Raspberry Pi, and he was playing with them. I said, well, how did you learn the programming language? And he said, oh, I would look at other people's programs and I'd like try to figure things out. And yeah, you can do that. You can pick it up in pieces. The problem is that you'll end up with what I call voids, which are like holes in Swiss cheese. And you don't know they're there because you can't know what you don't know. And for instance, he didn't know what an argument is in a programming language. You can write a program without knowing what an argument is, but you have an easier time if you do know and you do understand the syntax, and then you can write your own statements instead of just copy-pasting somebody else's. So I'm a great believer in the wonderful ability that we have now to educate ourselves, but it should really be done in a relatively methodical way, so that you build one thing on top of another instead of taking a piece here. And that's really the underlying structure of my own book. I had to think long and hard, what is the most logical way to build a knowledge of electronic components? And with the conclusion that the first thing to learn, contrary to everyday wisdom, is what is electrical resistance? Because you can measure that so easily. You just take a multimeter and touch it to your skin, put the probes in a glass of water. Resistance is everywhere. And then after resistance, I get to voltage. And then finally, I get to current, which is where most people would start. But I think that's a better way to do it.
Particularly with the internet today, it's easy to start things and you can find this or that. But actually, getting as far as you want to go is hard.
Yes.
It's moving from beginner to intermediate. People just get stuck sometimes and they stop at the most basic things. And it's actually a general rule that applies beyond technology. It's true of cooking and things.
I'm not a fan of cooking, but when I first started taking care of my own meals, I read The Joy of Cooking, and I thought that was a wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book.
It was very practical, but it also contained the theory.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to know why a copper bottom pan works better than one which has some other kind of metal at the bottom, they told you that. And I thought that was a great model to follow, to tell you how to do things, but at the same time say, by the way, if you're interested, this is why it works.
And, so that's two things about that book that I think is fascinating. And one is it really was for the everyday cook. It's not for a gourmet. It's like there's other books that have that goal. And
right.
It was like, here's how to do things in a regular way. And second, it's not a book you read cover to cover. You use it differently than a lot of books. I've always wanted The Joy of Making, which was comprehensive enough to help you orient to a lot of different areas. But
that sounds like a big book, Dale.
Yeah, it's probably just a thing that sounds good on paper, but not practical. But it really, though, it gets at this, that I think what interests me about publishing and making and writing books and the magazine is how do we get more knowledge into people's hands? How do we get more people able to do things? You have to learn how to do things, or you have to be a good learner to do these things. But there are tools out there that help you learn. Uh-huh. And as opposed to being passive consumer, I don't know how to do this, or everything should be easy, and when it gets difficult, I just stop.
Of course, YouTube has been a huge
Absolutely.
Change in how people learn. When I wanted to tighten a grab handle in my off-road vehicle, what was I going to do? Was I going to try prying the little plastic thing off and see if I could find a screw underneath or this or that? No, of course not. I went to YouTube and there it was. And 2 minutes later, the job was done. So that is a big change in how people learn, but it's all bite-sized inevitably. And consequently, I think it's very valuable, and I've certainly thought of doing YouTube videos myself, but it's not quite the way I would want to learn if I'm getting more interested, if I want to go beyond just tightening a handle in my car, and I want to learn more about the car generally, then I think I want a book. Mm-hmm. That's my attitude. And I don't want an electronic version, because I would really like to have a book beside me, open, with all that wonderful high-res that we have on a book page, tiny little letters and pictures containing a lot of detail.
Your book is lots of illustrations, lots of diagrams, lots of things that you can learn visually in a book as well as the reading part of it. And online, those things, they're more difficult to use.
Everything is more available, but more difficult, I think. I went a bit extreme with this book. It's 125,000 words. Yeah. So, which people do seem to read, so much for the theory that, oh, no one has attention span these days. I think they have attention span if they're interested. And there's 300 diagrams, photographs, illustrations. And I think the fact that it's in color throughout is important. Thanks to you, Dale, for taking that big chance at the time. Can we really afford to do 350 pages in full color? No one else had done that. All of the other books were in muddy black and white. Yeah. And that was a huge advantage. Like, first of all, at the most basic level, I could color code my diagrams for wiring. And I could then refer in the text to the blue wire.
Or the red instead wire. Of which shade of gray.
Well, or the wire that is labeled such and such. And so I think the whole package was important. And that to me was the lesson as to why the book was successful. We managed to get everything right, which is very hard and sometimes a matter of luck, that we just got everything the right mix. That's why it worked.
One of the things I'm excited about with the maker movement is that there's young people out there that are as interested in this, like your teenager reader that you imagined. There are teenagers out there, and younger even, that are interested in learning this. It isn't just people my age or your age who learned this along the way, but there's a new generation that's curious, that often doesn't get to learn this in school, doesn't get a full course in this kind of thing. And the other thing that's also interesting, like we talked about earlier, is there are people that are in very different fields. It could be biomedical design or something. And they find themselves to understand to build a device, I need to understand the electronics. So people, I think, are often trained in a silo, but I think when they get out and they want to do stuff, they realize they need to broaden and pick up other areas and at least become conversant in it.
Yeah, I tried to make the book as broad as possible. There are a few things I had to leave out, but then I put them into the sequel, Make More Electronics, like op amps, for instance. It's such a big field and relatively hard to explain. So I decided to leave them out of this introductory book, but I gathered in as much as I could so that by the time you finish reading it, you really should be able to build circuits of your own and certainly be able to hook up things that are relatively simple, like temperature measurement, and for instance, or do your own motion sensing, outdoor lighting, things like that, because the basic concepts are there. And then you have your own particular interest. Like I just discovered, there's a whole field now in people making microscopic models of things. Tiny railroad trains like this big, and then they want to put little LED lights inside the trains or signaling and so on. And of course, you can now use your own surface mount LEDs, which are equally tiny. So the field always goes off in some fascinating new direction.
Give us a summary of the new edition, just for those that might be familiar with the earlier editions. What would they see that's new or expanded in this edition?
Every writer I've ever known always looks back at his previous work and says, now that I'm looking at it with 6 years of perspective, I think I could do a better job. So I started with that natural inclination, and I think I have. It's a matter of rewriting to make some explanations even clearer. I redid all of the breadboard diagram circuit layouts because I wanted to make them, how can I put it, more graphical, easier to perceive. I don't believe that photographs of breadboard layouts are useful because there's always something you can't quite see, even if it's just the stripes on a resistor. But if you have a really good diagram, you can make it clearer. So I tried to do diagrams which are photographic but they have the clarity that a photograph misses. And that's throughout the entire book. So this is a very substantial amount of work to redo everything. Then there are some things I simply had to bring up to date. For instance, I had used single bus breadboards, which are now getting hard to find. So I had to redo everything with dual bus breadboards, which are now the standard. A lot of stuff like that. I also reshuffled some things to make a more logical sequence. As I mentioned earlier, I have a friendly relationship with someone who does component kits. And from his point of view, there were some things which he knew his customers would want, which is compromising on my desire to have a wide range of components and just focusing on the components which are most useful so people don't have to spend so much money buying parts. Parts in electronics are cheap, and you can get an LED or a transistor for maybe 5 cents. But when you start adding everything up, I wanted to make it more affordable. So those were some of the things that were going through my mind.
Thank you, Charles, for talking to me about your new edition of Make Electronics, and I look forward to reading it myself.
Thanks very much, Dale. Always a pleasure.
Make Electronics 3rd Edition can be found on Amazon or at makershed.com.